And it's a real pleasure to have Jonathan Taylor as the first speaker. He's been a student first of Steve in Montreal, and then moved to Stanford, back to Montreal, back to Stanford now.
Yes.
It's a wonderful stuff. It's one of the, this rare place where excellent mathematicians do bring something very important for the field. So it's a very real pleasure.
Thank you very much, Jean-Baptiste, for the nice introduction. Is that too loud? I hear a sort of echo. Can you hear me at the back or?
Good.
Good? Okay. So my original title for the talk was actually not supplied by me, but was supplied by Keith, was Advances in Random Field Theory, Non-Negative Least Squares. But I thought, since this is a summer school, I think I take the opportunity to try and give a sort of pedagogic talk about just sort of the multiple comparisons problem in brain imaging. So it might be a little dry, and it definitely won't showcase a whole bunch of new things, but I think for those of you who are coming to the summer school and thinking of it as a learning experience and you've never seen this stuff, I hope you'll get something out of that. And I hope I won't make too many mistakes. So I'm going to start off with a motivating example that is a sort of generic, if you will, fMRI study that you might find in your lab. This is the FIAC study that's been mentioned a few times already, and it was very nice of JB to put this study together for people like myself and Keith to get our hands on a full study rather than just a few single runs. So we had 16 subjects, and for each subject, we had roughly 4 runs per subject. Not everyone had all the runs, and there was a few quirks, so we didn't actually end up with a full 16 subjects and a full 4 run per subject, but we had quite a good amount of data to work with, and it's a language task. There are 4 different conditions where there are sentences repeated by speakers, and there are some sentences that are repeated, so same sentence, and repeated by the same speaker, and that was all various combinations of those two possibilities, sentence and speaker. And for those of you who know what this means, and I don't, 3T, for engineering purposes, this is some of the acquisition information. Okay, and to get right to what I want to sort of talk about, I'm going to show you a slide from the report that Keith and I put together on this, this contest that shows the sentence effect, and I apologize for the font because these are just cut out of PDF files, it's kind of blurry, sentence effect for the block trials. And we have the estimated sentence effect for each of these subjects, and you'll see there's not a full 16 here, but 14. And we have estimated standard deviation for the sentence effect, and this is in a particular slice. The slice is described here. And we have a t-statistic. This is a single subject t-statistic, so within subject testing, which is essentially the ratio of these two images. And what I want to talk about is something about this t-statistic image here, which is the random effects t-statistic for testing at each particular voxel, whether there is a sentence effect or not. And I want to sort of talk about, starting at this point, what is done, maybe not done too often, and nothing further is done, but what it's typically done with a t-statistic image like this, and how you come up with reports like a corrected p-value at 0.05 that you might put into a neuroscience paper. So we'll talk a little mostly about thresholding and a sort of fairly vanilla version of thresholding. That is, I won't talk about all the bells and whistles that I could, that other people and myself have done some work on, but I just want to give a basic idea of a few different approaches to thresholding and compare them for this sentence block effect. So the first one I'll talk about, because this is what pays the bills for me, I guess, is the random field theory. Then I'll talk a bit about some non-parametric methods like a permutation test, and some I'll talk a little bit about false discovery rate, FDR, which we'll hear a little bit more about in the third talk of this session. And I should say, this isn't a complete comprehensive review. If you want a more comprehensive review, Tom Nichols and his student Satoru Hayasaka, they have a nice paper summarizing this kind of stuff for actually on simulated data. But just to give a rough idea of the comparison between these different methods. And I should say, besides for the random fields part of this talk, I think Tom should really be giving this kind of talk because he's the best prepared to talk about permutation methods, at least. And but it's me giving the talk. and my goal is to really try and explain some of the mechanics of these approaches and to compare the results. So what is this multiple comparisons problem that I'm referring to? Well, I'll give you two quick examples of the kind of what I mean by a multiple comparisons problem as a formal definition for a statistician. So let's say we're in a single run, that is, going back to my data over here, I look at a single subject. Actually, these are the combination of two runs, but we could pretend it is just a single run. It's just an average of two runs. And we want to find what are the voxels for this single subject that show a descendant effect. So the typical approach that's taken on by various packages is to fit a GLM, a linear model, voxel by voxel, using some sort of two-stage procedure, maybe estimating some correlation structure in the noise. And for every subject at every voxel, we come up with a test statistic, and in this case, it's a t-statistic, that tests whether the sentence effect for that subject at that voxel is zero. So now, we have lots of x's. Those are voxels in the brain, typically thousands to hundreds of thousands or 100,000. And so that's the multiple in the comparisons. And the comparisons are these tests of these particular hypotheses. So for a statistician, a multiple comparison problem is taking a whole collection of these hypotheses, these are indexed by x, and having, say, a test statistic for each hypothesis, and trying to decide which ones are true nulls and which ones are false nulls, which ones should be rejected. So that random effects t-statistic I showed you is not within a single run, but it's, a multi-subject test. So for each subject, from 1 to 14 in this case, we have an estimate at each voxel of their sentence effect and an estimate of their the standard deviation of the sentence effect. And we want to come up with a test statistic to test whether in the population, in a particular mixed effects model, the coefficient, the sentence effect is zero at that location. And that's usually done with a simple mixed effects model. Okay, so those are the kind of problems that I want to talk about. And this, you can imagine lots of different examples of this kind of multiple comparisons setup. This could fit into an anatomical study where we're doing VBM, comparing different anatomical images at each location over a population, and fit some kind of linear model as you do in VBM, and come up with a similar kind of test statistic. So, I mean, the generic problem is just having lots of test statistics to test particular, lots of hypotheses. And the question is, what do you do with those? So how can we use this image of text statistics, TX, for all X in the brain? How can you decide, what are reasonable ways to decide which of these are false nulls and which of these are true nulls? And in the specific examples, how can we decide where there is a sentence effect or whether there is any sentence effect in the random effects analysis? And so the most common thing to do is to take these test statistics and to threshold them. And so that's, let's say we're going to create a decision rule, D indexed by a threshold, that says any point X where the test statistic is bigger than U, we're going to reject that null hypothesis. And that's basically the most common thing to do with the T-statistic image once you once you form the t-statistic image, and it gives you results something like this, a sort of list of local maxima that survived this whatever thresholding rule you chose. So this is a summary of all the significant local maxima in that FIA paper, and this has a sentence, I guess we're in the sentence block effect, so there was four different local maxima that passed whatever the threshold was. The threshold turned out to be about 5.67, so this one was right on the border, and I'm going to try and tell you a little bit about how we come up with 5.67, and you can see that you have the similar results for the different types of different event types and different designs. So this is something many people do every day, and I just want to go through the mechanics of it a bit. They may not realize what the mechanics are, and that's what I'm trying to go through. Okay, and it also gives you results like this, where you can sort of threshold your image at the 0.05 corrected value. And I apologize, it's not a great view, but you can see there's some bilateral activation, and me not being a neuroscientist, we were told that we're roughly in the right area, and I'll have to take someone else's word on that. And I'm sorry I have to apologize for that, but I don't really know all the areas involved here. So you get these typical images, blobs or something like this. You can call the study of these things, I think it's sometimes called blobology, and trying to interpret where the locations of these and what you can say, what more you can say about them. And so that's the random field threshold. And I will try and explain where the random field threshold comes from and a few different techniques for thresholding. Another thing that people sometimes do that is actually sometimes preferred and often preferred to the thresholding is to do something called spatial extent or cluster extent. And what is done here is, well, we take the image of test statistics, we choose some threshold. Now, we're not trying to find a threshold for this threshold is arbitrary, but generally chosen to be, if it's a t-statistic, a common choice is 3, I believe. And we threshold our test statistics at level 3. So we look at all the blobs above level 3, and for each blob, we can compute the volume, and there's some correction for non-stationarity that can be done, but we look at this collection of the sizes of the spatial extents and try and come up with a way of deciding which of the largest of these blobs really would not occur under a model where there's no sentence effect. And so if you have large clusters that are larger than you would expect if there was no sentence effect in the study, then that's evidence for activation. And one of the things about the spatial extent is you lose a little bit of specificity because now you have just this blob that is significant. You don't necessarily have the specificity of having a local maxima that is significant. But if you take into account the fact that the activation probably varies from subject to subject, probably the local maxima is a little questionable, and the blob might cover a whole region of different subjects, centers of activation. And so you do something like this, threshold your test statistic at image 3, test statistic image at 3, you get a whole collection of blobs and compute the volumes of all of these blobs, and then try and determine whether you would expect to see a blob as large as this one according under model there's no sentence effect, and if it's large enough you declare it significant. And actually I don't have the cluster threshold for this data, so I will just skip how you choose that threshold. I'm going to talk more about thresholding. So what is a principled way to choose this threshold? So I'll talk about a few different ways of choosing the threshold. One is based on what we call the family-wise error rate of the thresholding rule. And so we'll talk about random field methods and permutation methods for family-wise error rate. And another one is false discovery rate, which is a different criterion used to select threshold. So what is the family-wise error rate of the procedure? So the family-wise error rate of our procedure is the probability, the true probability, that is not the null probability, but the true probability that any true null are any true null hypotheses are falsely rejected when we use this thresholding rule du. And so that's the probability that there's some x where there's no sentence effect that our test statistic passed the level u. And it's often safe to assume that this is the same probability as if there really was no sentence effect everywhere, especially in these typical linear models, I can make this switch pretty easily. The probability that there's no sentence effect anywhere, the same probability but under the model where there's no sentence effect anywhere, and I can bound this probability by the probability that the largest test statistic is above the level u. And so if we're to choose a threshold that will control the Fan-Lawrence error rate, we want to choose a threshold so that this probability that is a bound on the Fan-Lawrence error rate is approximately our nominal level alpha. And to control that Fan-Lawrence error rate, that means you at least have to be able to say something about the probability that the largest test statistic is above the level u, and that the probability that the maximum of the t statistic is above the level u. So that's the random field methods all come in sort of into approximating this probability. And there's other ways to approximate the probability that I'll talk about as well. So a few different approaches are, the simplest one is the Bonferroni correction that everyone should see at least once, so they know, because it's the most commonly used multiple comparisons procedure, I would say. And I'll talk a little bit more about the Euler characteristic heuristic. That's this random field theory method that's commonly applied and is spit out, for instance, in Keith's package fMRI stat. You have these corrected p-values for the maxima based on this Euler characteristic heuristic. There's also something called discrete local maxima that takes into account the fact that we don't ever really observe a continuum of data, but we only observe it on a lattice, and sometimes gives a better approximation to the probability than the expected Euler characteristic. I won't have time to go into the DLM today. And I'll talk a bit about permutation tests. So permutation tests, they're almost like a non-parametric way to estimate that probability. It's not quite, it's more like they're a way of estimating the p-value of your test rather than the distribution of the maximum. But they fall into the same category, and they're still trying to control the Fan-Lawrence error rate. And all of the, I don't know about Bonferroni, but the random field methods and permutation methods can also be used for this space, this cluster extent feature rather than the maximum, if you want to use that. Okay. So what's the Bonferroni inequality? This is statistics 201, maybe, not 101. But it's based on this very simple bound for the probability of the maximum. So the probability that the largest t is above the level u, and this is a maximum over some number of voxels, maybe 100,000, maybe more. Well, this standard probability inequality says that's less than or equal to the sum over all the voxels, the probability that the test statistic is above the level u, and that leads to a threshold. The Bonferroni threshold is to change the nominal level of significance alpha to alpha divided by the total number of voxels. So if you're, instead of going looking at a threshold for a marginal threshold of 0.05, you go to 5 × 10⁻⁸ if you have a million voxels, or 5 × 10⁻⁷ if you have 100,000. And so that's the simplest, and in this case, the Bonferroni threshold is actually not too different than the random field threshold. I think it's, instead of 5.7, it's about 5.9. And, well, this is what happens to the blobs. I only have one of the views there for that same sentence block effect. So you can, it's fairly similar. It's a little, in this case, it's a little bit more conservative than the random field method. But some cases, the random field method is much better. And in some cases, actually, the random field correction is on the other side of Bonferroni. So you know the random field correction is way too conservative when it's on the other side of Bonferroni. But it depends on the smoothness of the data. That's the large determining factor of whether it's too conservative or not. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about the Euler characteristic heuristic. So instead of the just completely vanilla, maybe this is vanilla with a low-fat chocolate sauce or something. I want to talk a little bit about, a little details about this one, because this is what I spent a lot of my time, or have spent a lot of my time working on since I was a student. And it's a really nice, since this is a math institute, this is the one that's most heavily mathy. So I can talk a little bit about that, but I won't go into too big of details. So what do I need to assume to use these random field methods? Well, we have to assume a particular form for the test statistic. So we assume that our test statistic T of X can be written as a function. I mean, you can relax this a little bit, but this is the most of the test statistics are of this form, as a function of, well, a vector of Gaussian random fields, and these Gaussian random fields should be IID. So as random fields are independent, and they, well, we center them and have unit variance. And if we can write the test statistic in this form, then there's a fairly direct way to get the random field correction. And this should be a function of the first one to the kth one. So let's say we have k independent random fields. We write our test statistic as a function of k of them. And that's basically what we need to use this random, this Euler characteristic heuristic. So are these assumptions reasonable? Well, the IID assumption is fairly reasonable for multi-subject comparisons, but the Gaussianity one is obviously one that many people can, it's a straw man, it can be easily objected to, yet it's something that we would have to make or appeal to a central limit theorem if we don't want to make the assumption too precise. But that's the assumptions we have to make, and let me give you an example. Let's do the simplest example of a one-sample t-statistic. So let's suppose I observe data for subjects I from 1 to n, every voxel, yi is some mean at the voxel, plus one of these IID random fields at that voxel. And I want to test the null hypothesis that the mean at that voxel is 0. Well, the simplest way to do this is to form a one-sample t-statistic, testing whether the mean is 0. And under the null hypothesis that the mean really is zero, you can write the t-statistic, and this is the form for the t-statistic under this null hypothesis. And by the standard trick you learn when you do any sort of regression course, you can write this t-statistic as, well, the numerator, which is the sample mean of the epsilons times square root of n, you can write that as some other epsilon tilde, that's another centered unit variance Gaussian, and divided by the sum of squares of n minus 1 Gauss unit mean standard normal squared rather than the residual squared. So I can write the standard t-statistic in this form, hence I can use this sort of random field correction to if I was looking at a one sample t. Okay, and so what does this correction look like? So it says it's an approximation to this probability, the probability that the largest test statistic you see is bigger than or equal to u. And it has this fairly simple form. It's a sum, and the number of terms in the sum is the dimension plus 1. So if it's volumetric data, there are 4 terms in the sum. If it's surface data, there are 3 terms in the sum. And it's a sum of some functions or functionals of the brain. So that's the search region. I use brain here instead of search region, but let's just suppose I'm doing whole brain analysis, so that stands in for my search region, times something, some functions of the threshold u. So it has this nice separation into a sum of two types of products of two different types of terms. And of course, in practice, you have to estimate some of these quantities. These functions here are known functions generally we know them for a lot of different types of test statistics. And these things are things that have to be estimated from the data. These things are sort of geometric functionals of the brain, and they have different names, many different names in geometry. They're either the intrinsic volumes of the brain, Lipschitz-Killing curvatures of the brain, or in neuroimaging, these are the resels, usually. And that there may be a scale I'm missing full width half max in the resel language, but I never get the full width half max in the sigma. I can only work with intrinsic volumes. I can't work with full with half maxes. Okay. So, and the, as I said, these functions are called the Euler characteristic densities, and they depend on the particular test statistics that, that are chosen. So if I have a one sample t statistic, these are TEC densities, and they depend on the degrees of freedom, and you know, I can tell you what they are, and I'll show you a very complicated version for an F in a minute, but they're known. And you know, one of the things that Keith and I spend a lot of time on is computing them. So we can tell you what they are if you need to know. So let me say a little bit more about these intrinsic volumes. So let me just talk about the main term. The biggest term in that sum is usually the term corresponding to the highest dimension. So if I'm in volumetric data, it's usually the volume term. And if I have isotropic random fields, then this volume term is some scalar times the volume of the brain, the volume of the search region. And where this lambda here has to do with the variance, is the variance of the derivative of this random field in any particular unit direction. If it's a non-isotropic random field, well then these intrinsic volumes have are can be written as an integral of a sort of density, where this density has something to do with the roughness of the random field. That is, this it's the integral of the determinant of the square root of the determinant of the covariance matrix of the derivatives of the random field. And for those of you who like geometry and Riemannian geometry, this is actually gives a Riemannian metric on the search region, and it's sort of pulled back from the covariance function of the random field. And these other integrals that show up, these other intrinsic volumes, they are geometric quantities that are hard to describe, but they are functionals of the Riemannian functionals. So I won't get into I won't try and write out the formula. The second one is not that bad. The second one is just the surface area, or half the surface area. And if it's non-isotropic, it's half the surface area computed with respect to this Riemannian structure. But I think Keith might spend a little bit more time on this in his talk about estimating these intrinsic volumes, but not I don't know how much more he will spend. But I'm going to go on to the EC densities. So what are these functions? So let's suppose I have a Gaussian test statistic, and think of that as having a one sample T with many, many subjects so high that the T statistic is roughly Gaussian. And so what these EC densities have a particularly simple form in this case. They are constants times Hermite polynomials times the Gaussian density. I could take one of those two pi's over there if I want. And so that's a fairly simple form. They get a little more complicated. If you had an F random field, this is what the full F EC density looks like. I won't ask you to reproduce that. It's difficult to reproduce that. But suffice it to say that you know once you've done it once, you have this formula, and you can use it in the random field correction. So let me just say a little bit about where these EC densities come from. So in the talks that I often give in if it's sort of a math or probability colloquium, I would spend a lot more time just on actually all describing all these intrinsic volumes. And actually on this slide here, where these Euler EC densities come from. And that's kind of the very beautiful part of this whole subject area, but I don't want to overwhelm you with details. So I'll just try and explain in one slide how you get these EC densities for particular tests. And I'll show you some pictures that they give you an example of how you might apply this. So for any particular test statistic, so that's a function of my k random fields, and it's a function of k numbers. So the I can write I can call the region where that test statistic is above the level u, or the rejection region, and that's some subset in Rk, if my test statistic is a function of k Gaussian fields. And let me call the tube of radius epsilon around the rejection region to be all the points in Rk that are distance epsilon from the rejection region. Okay, so that's some set. It's slightly bigger than the rejection region, bigger by it's like dilating the rejection region by both the ball of radius epsilon, if you like the morphometric language. And so where you get these Euler characteristic densities is now you start computing the probability of this tube. So it's a set in Rk, and marginally I have independent normals, standard normals, so that gives me a distribution in RK. I could compute the probability of this set as a function of epsilon, and well, if that function is smooth, I can expand it in a power series, and reading off the power series, the coefficients of the power series actually gives you those EC densities. So that's kind of a neat result, and it actually gives you about a one-line derivation of these EC densities, if you like, but I won't go through that, or maybe two lines. And you can use this sort of formula to get actually to get this off this long expression. It doesn't look like this, it's actually a lot simpler, but you can use this formula with a neat little picture that I'll show you in a second to try and get the EC densities for an F random field. So a lot of what Keith and I have been working on recently is sort of applications of this to different types of test statistics. And I'll show you one. The one advance I'll show you in a little bit is applying this to a special type of random field. And I realize I'm going a little too slow for all I have to cover, so I won't be able to get it through everything. But that's usually what I have, too much rather than too little. And I should just say that these intrinsic volumes that I mentioned of the brain, they are also coefficients in a particular tube expansion. And so if, in particular, if you have isotropic random fields, these intrinsic volumes are coefficients in the volume, the Lebesgue volume of a tube around the brain, if you will. There are also tube connections to these formulas as well. And that these functionals are these classical functionals that show up everywhere in classical integral geometry, like the kinematic fundamental formula, Crofton's formula. They all involve these intrinsic volumes. So they're very well studied classical integral geometric things. So this is the random field corrected threshold again. We've seen this picture. The threshold turned out to be about 5.7. You get a little bit more than Bonferroni, but in this case they're quite similar. And let me show you a little picture of one of these rejection regions, one of the tubes of these rejection regions. So I have a title here that, you know, this is what keeps Keith and I amused these days, partly at least, is trying to is drawing rejection regions, that is the exterior of this red cone here, and tubes around the rejection regions, these green things here. So what we have here is an F, it's a rejection region for an F statistic, I think with 2 and 1 degrees of freedom, and we have the tube of radius, some radius epsilon around that rejection region. And so now this is some set in R3, I can only show pictures in R3 in 3 dimensions, and so now you, to get the EC densities, you have to compute this probability. And if you stare at this picture long enough with some sort of high school geometry, you can come up with nice probability statements to compute the probability of this tube as a function of the radius. And so that's the kind of, that's some of the stuff that keeps us busy. Okay. So let me show you another different kind of random field. So this is related to the sort of cone that I just showed you before, but this is not related to the FIAC study, but Keith wanted me to include some of these, some advance in random field theory, so here it is. This is an example where we're going to estimate a human dynamic response function as a sum of a linear combination of basis functions, which we're going to put a constraint on the coefficients of the basis in front of the basis functions. So I'll just show you results from a single subject, and it's not the FIAC data, but it's a block design pain experiment, where we modeled the hemodynamic response at a particular voxel as a function of time as a linear combination of different basis hemodynamic response functions. And this leads to a particular kind of F statistic that's called a cone F statistic. And I'll show you another tube around a rejection region in a few slides to show you what kind of tube calculation you have to do for these kinds of test statistics. But let me try and motivate this sort of constrained HRF estimation first. So let's suppose we don't want to model the HRF at every particular voxel as with one canonical HRF, as we generally know that that's not going to be adequate for covering the whole brain, but maybe as a linear combination of, in this case, three different hemodynamic response functions. So maybe a canonical one, one that's shifted by a certain amount by 4 seconds to the right, and one that's sort of flattened, that sort of attenuates the peak of the canonical HRF. So we're going to model at every voxel the hemodynamic response function as a linear combination of these three, but we're going to assume that the coefficients are positive. And why are we going to assume that the coefficients are positive? Because, well, if we let the coefficients be completely unrestrained, then we get a lot of different weird-looking hemodynamic response functions. So what's shown here is for various combinations of the hemodynamic response functions, the general shape of the HRF. And you see only in a particular regions you really get sort of reasonable-looking HRFs. So this condition that the coefficients be positive is a way to ensure that you have you're not wasting effort by trying to fit these weird-looking HRFs. You're only trying to fit reasonable-looking HRFs. And so you can easily, it's not too hard to estimate the coefficients with this constraint. It's a fairly simple procedure. And you might now consider testing whether there's any activation at these voxels. So if you had unconstrained coefficients, you'd have an F with 3 degrees of freedom in the numerator. But with these constraints, you get this something we call the cone F. And let me just show you. You get another rejection region for this cone F that has another nice, pretty tube around it. That's you can work out the probability fairly easily for these kinds of tests. And the results. This is within a single subject. Let's see. Well, this is the cone F, and if we look at the size, this is the size of the rejection region for just a t-test for only one, the canonical one, an f-test with 3 degrees of freedom in the numerator, or the cone f, and well, we get a little bit larger activation region with the constrained HRF estimation. So that is roughly all I have to say about random field theory and the Euler characteristic heuristic. And so what is there to note about this method? Well, it relies on this Gaussianity assumption that you either have to assume or sweep under the rug with the central limit theorem kind of argument, which many of us are, or some of us are happy to do. It's known, but work of Tom and his students have shown that it's fairly conservative for if you have low degrees of freedom in the denominator of your test statistics, such and as we saw, that's often the case in the multi-subject fMRI studies, we often don't have very high degrees of freedom, but at least it does give you a guideline for fairly complicated statistics. For instance, that test statistic I described with the non-negative least squares, it would be hard to come up with the permutation test, I think, to correct for within a single subject, say, for this kind of constrained estimator, because you no longer have the symmetry of being able to flip the signs with these constraints. But so I think it's a good, I think even if you are going to stick to permutation tests that I'll describe in a minute, these random field thresholds are fairly good guidelines that can serve as are useful in their own right. And mathematically, there's lots of beautiful geometry in this, which is why I really like this area. And there are often other applications in other parts of statistics besides brain imaging, such as astrophysics and classical multivariate statistics. And if you want to explore the geometry, it's really a nice area. And as Robert Adler, who works with Keith and I a lot on this stuff, does have many applications. You know, it has tenure for students, promotion to full professor perhaps, publications, and various other things. But it does have actually scientific applications too. Robert tells that joke much better than me. But okay. So I want to talk a little bit about permutation tests, and I know I won't get to FDR, so let's see what I can say about permutation tests. So this is a non-parametric alternative to this random field theory that allows you to not assume that you have assume anything about the distribution really of the test statistics, or that is your estimated effects and estimated standard deviations, and it's essentially a way of approximating the distribution of this maximum, but non-parametrically. And I say it's essentially that because it's not really estimating this, but it's estimating a p-value, which is different. So there are a few assumptions you have to make. They are assumptions you'd be making in the Gaussian case anyways. So what are the assumptions? You have to assume that the subjects in the study are exchangeable. That is, the distribution of the test statistics is invariant under permutations of permutation of the subjects, and that the effects, if you're just using the effects, are going to be symmetric under sign changes of the image as a whole. Under that, and that has to be under the global null hypothesis that there's no sentence effect anywhere. And I'm going to talk about using the maximum t for the permutations, but you can use lots of different, you can use fairly general test statistics rather than just the maximum in this permutation framework. And if you have more questions about the specifics for neuroimaging, I would counsel you to ask Tom Nichols for more details. But I just want to compare it to the random field theory. So back to our slice of data, we have the estimated effects and standard deviations. And what we're going to do is, actually, for what I'll talk about, is I'm going to throw away the standard deviations and just use the effects in the permutation procedures. There are some. You do lose a little bit of efficiency by ignoring the information you learned within a single subject and throwing away the standard deviations, but hopefully that's not too much. And I think, I mean, I know Jean-Baptiste's group has a way of actually not throwing away these standard deviations in their permutation techniques. But again, in the spirit of vanilla, I'm just going to do the simplest one, which is to just use the effects themselves. So for each voxel x, I have these 14 effects. I can compute a sample mean for those 14 effects at each voxel and a sample variance, or I guess here with standard deviation, but the sample variance of that voxel. And what we're going to use as a test statistic is basically, if you look at the ratio of the mean to the square root of the variance, that gives you a t at each voxel, and we're roughly going to use the maximum t for signed permutations of the data. And so we're not just going to use the maximum t, we're going to use this pseudo t, which sort of bypasses the low degrees of freedom in a t statistic by giving you a better estimate of the variance. So what we're going to do is take the sample mean, and we're going to take the image of sample variance, smooth it with a particular smoothing kernel, and then recompute the square root to get a standard deviation, and form what we'll call a pseudo-t. So this smoothing of the variance here actually buys you a few degrees of freedom, because what is degrees of freedom really? It's really a measure of how accurate an estimate you have of a variance. And smoothing this variance does give you a better estimate of the voxel-wise variance if you assume there's some underlying smooth variance. But it's no longer really a t anymore, because you're averaging non-independent chi-squares. And actually, the t-image that I showed you for the mixed effect is also a kind of pseudo-t. That is, there are many of these, I shouldn't say many, but in the sort of fMRI stat package that Keith has and I sort of implemented in Python, we do smoothing of various variances or ratios of variances. So in effect, our t-statistics are actually pseudo-t's. They're not quite t. So it's not quite a t-random field when we apply it, but we hope we're close, I guess, is the easiest thing to say. So what we're going to do, the mechanics of the procedure is fairly simple. You take each vector of signs in -1, 1 to the number of subjects, and you construct the vector of sign-flipped effects. So you take each effect you had and multiply by each sign in this vector, and that gives you the sign-flipped effects. For each of those vectors, you compute the image sample mean, the image sample variance, and the image of pseudo-t's, and that gives you now a whole collection, in this case 2 to the 14 pseudo-t images. And for each of these pseudo-t images, we're going to choose a feature, and we decided to use the maximum, just like we did for the random field theory, the maximum of the pseudo-t over all voxels in the brain. And ultimately, we're going to compare the observed maximum pseudo-t for the vector, when the signed vectors are all ones, to the population of these pseudo-t's for all the different sign vectors. So what you can as you go over these 2 to the 14 different sign vectors, you get a collection of pseudo-t's and a collection of maximum pseudo-t's, and you get a histogram something like this. Turns out our observed pseudo-t is somewhere out around 12, so it's quite far out in the tails of this histogram. So we can, I think the p-value is 0.002 corrected, so we can reject the null hypothesis there is any sentence effect, and that there is a sentence effect. And let me just show you, this is a threshold of the pseudo-t. I should say, I don't think I smoothed enough here. I didn't use Tom's package, I did this by hand. The 0.05 threshold for this pseudo-t was about 9, which is pretty high. Generally, I believe the pseudo-t threshold is a little lower than the t threshold for random field theory, but here it turned out to be 9. That may be because our pseudo-t has 40 degrees of freedom, and degrees of freedom in quotes. But in any case, so I've lowered the threshold here to 6 to show you that you do get reassuringly roughly the same results as the random field theory, but you didn't have to make as many assumptions, which is the real benefit of computation methods. The downside is sometimes it takes a while to compute, but computers are getting faster and more efficient, and we're getting more processors, so it's not too much of an issue generally. Okay, so things to note about permutation methods is that, well, first of all, as I said, if you just do this very simple, the very simple permutation test where you throw out the standard deviation, you lose perhaps a little bit of efficiency. Because you did learn something in the first stage, but it's very simple just to throw them out. I don't think I smoothed enough in my particular example. As I said, usually you get a less conservative threshold with permutation methods than random field theory. And you can really, I just use the maximum, the max t as a statistic, but of course there are lots of other statistics you can use, like the cluster extent, non-stationary cluster extent, and JB's group has a likelihood ratio test for a random effects model in this permutation framework. And so you can use lots of interesting test statistics in the permutation setup. The one assumption you have to make is that your experimental design has to support this exchangeability, which is usually really not a problem if you're doing multi-subject stuff, and the symmetry, which is also not too big of a problem. And anyways, these are assumptions you'd be making if you were using the random field theory in the multiple comparison setting. So I did have some slides about false discovery rate, but I think I'm basically out of time, and we're going to hear more about false discovery rate later this afternoon, so I think I'll stop here.
You use several methods, let's say you use random field theory and use the permutation method to come up with your p-values. Could you use something like the mean of the two of them? Would that be kosher? I know that would impose the assumption that you are imposing the structure of a set of the assumptions, but...
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be kosher to say that that's uniform. So the question is, if you have many different, say, procedures to control Fanois error rate, can you just take the one that gives you the best p-value and report that? So it's not statistically kosher because, well, you'll have the wrong distribution under the global null, most likely. First of all, because you're evaluating the test statistic on the same data. So there's no, well, you can't even assume they're independent test statistics. If they were independent test statistics based on the same data, which is kind of a little hard to imagine, but not that hard, you could work out the distribution if they were both correct, but generally that's not quite kosher, no. Yeah. Tom?
I was next door giving a talk on random field theory, so I'm not sure if you covered this. So what about cluster? So you seem to have a general framework to derive these Euler characteristic Mie densities for any statistic. How does that go with cluster size?
That's a good question. It's not as simple, and in this second book, we're trying to sort sort, I mean, Keith has done some of the work on sorting that out. I'm not as comfortable with the cluster stuff as Keith is, but maybe if we, if I look at it a little longer, I'll understand it better. But there's no general framework right now for transferring the this sort of GKF stuff to the cluster extent. And I don't know if you were at the beginning, but I did say that you should be giving this talk. So when you were giving your random field talk, you should have been giving this permutation one. But I think there's the problem is that you have to model each random field in a particular way get a quadratic approximation at high levels for each random field, and I don't know if that will work, will be an easily expressible in terms of the statistic, what form that quadratic form takes. But maybe there's hope. I don't know. Yes?
One point I didn't really understand is you were saying this F cone statistic would be difficult to test with in a permutation or randomization framework. Although I don't have sort of the concrete method, to me it seems that randomization is a very, very general framework for testing any kind of statistics. So to me it seems that there should be a way of doing that. Can you comment a little bit?
Well, I mean, so this is a little off the cuff that I made the comment, but I think it's so this symmetry may be broken, but maybe under the global null that's not an issue, because you can't just sort of, I mean, you have this constraint that the coefficients have to be positive,
What about a test where you randomize condition labels? Just because it's a framework that acquainted with.
But that's, I mean, if you, so this is within one condition testing whether for an effect in one condition. I mean, first, in a single subject, there's issues of exchangeability and time. You can't sort of do that resampling method. That's one reason why it would be difficult. But if you're doing a multi-subject test of these vectors of constrained estimators, then the permutation would be fine. But I was referring to the single subject sort of one, where there was not as natural randomization structure within a single subject. But multi-subject, no, that's fine. That's just another test statistic if you're permuting over subjects.
Sometimes it's actually quite hard, but sometimes you do the wrong test with permutation, especially by, for instance, like doing the permutation on the conditions of the experiment, then you can't interpret that. If you embed some of that in your test across subjects, then you can't interpret the result as a population test, a true random effect test. So it is sometimes a bit tricky, and you have to be careful. Anyway, I think for the sake of having refreshments and a bit of time to stretch your leg and things like that, I think we should stop there and maybe back in 10 minutes.
Okay.
And thanks again, John.